our text for this morning is Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 10. If you would please turn there, I'll read it in a moment and give you the setting for our study today. We've been studying Ecclesiastes 7 for quite some time, a number of sessions that is, and now we're just looking at individual verses. So today we come to chapter 7 and verse 10, which I think is just a very helpful passage. And I'm sure you'll enjoy our study, let's put it that way, especially if you're older and you talk about when you were a kid and what life was like then. But Solomon says in verse 10 of chapter 7, "Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? For it's not from wisdom that you ask about this." So let's ask the Lord to help us to delve into this. There's a lot to say about it. It's one simple verse. So Lord, we thank you and praise you for the book of Ecclesiastes, the many things that we've learned. And now, again, we focus on one verse and pray that we'll be able to draw out of this verse a help for life and for the past, present, and future. In Jesus' name, amen. So 2 weeks ago, we drew lessons out of another do not passage in Ecclesiastes. I'm sure you remember verse 21. Also, do not take seriously all words which are spoken. Do not take seriously, literally translates, do not take to heart all words that are spoken. Another way to say it is that do not take seriously everything that people say. So it's very practical. And we talked about considering the source of what people say, considering the circumstances when they say it, considering the spirit of the speaker, and considering the use of the words that were spoken. Now, there are 12 such passages in Ecclesiastes where we're told, do not do something. And it's interesting that in a book which describes the transitory nature of life, which is life is like trying to catch the wind, ceaseless change with perpetual sameness. It is interesting that in a book like that, or in a book that deals with that subject, that commands would be given. Why tell someone to do something or not to do something if nothing has meaning and life is futile? There would be no reason to say, well, you should do this or you should do that. But Solomon isn't saying that in this book, because in the book of Ecclesiastes, he speaks much about purpose, God's design, and the path in life that brings satisfaction to those who acknowledge God. So there are, as I said, 12 of these. There are four of these in chapter 5. I'll just mention them for your remembrance sake. Chapter 5 and verse 2, do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 4, when you make a vow, do not be late in paying it, for he takes no delight in fools, pay what you vow. Verse 6, do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God, it was a mistake. And also verse 8, if you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, do not be shocked at the sight. So there are four substantial statements like this in chapter 5. Let your words be few when you come to God in prayer. Pay your vows to God. Keep your speech from sinning. And don't be shocked at oppression. And I think you remember, it was probably a couple months ago we talked about those. Now there are five of these do nots in chapter 7. We already looked at three of them. Do not be excessively righteous, verse 16. Or do not be righteous much. Do not be excessively wicked. Do not be wicked much, verse 17. And then the one that I just mentioned, verse 21, do not take to heart everything that people say. There's one that we did not consider, and we probably won't. It's in verse 9. Do not be eager in your heart to be angry, for anger resides in the bosom of fools. So we're coming to the fifth one, which is verse 10. Do not say, why is it that the former days were better than these? So the way I propose to consider this statement is to talk about what people say, why they say it, and what's wrong with it. Simple enough. What people say, why they say it. So first of all, what is the text saying about what people say? Well, they say that the past was better than the present. They say that the present does not compare to what we had in the past. It is a complaint about the progression of time and circumstances from distant past life and experiences to the present, which is viewed by them as inferior and problematic compared to the past. Kyle explains that it is, and I quote, astonishment when he asks, what is it? How is it that the present is like this when the past was so wonderful? How did it happen that we're here when the past was so much better? Perhaps you would think eventually of the Ezra chapter 3 when the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, you remember, and the priests stood in their apparel with trumpets and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord according to the directions of King David of Israel. They sang, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, saying, He is good, but His loving kindness, for His loving kindness is upon Israel forever. And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. But then you read in verse 12, yet many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' households, the old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. And why did they weep? For this very reason. They thought about the past, and they couldn't rejoice in the present, what God was doing in their days. So it's easy to quarrel with the present, isn't it, and long for the past. There's no doubt that this text applies to everyone, but it has special relevance to those who are older, who have some history in this world, maybe middle age, whatever. Or if you're a young person and you study the past and you're conscientious about comparing the present with the past, you might have this feeling. But it's easy to quarrel with the present and long for the past. But that is not wise. Solomon says in the second part of verse 10, that is not wise. For it is not from wisdom that you ask about this. And it's a question, remember, why is it that the former days were better than these? Now, the past is an important part of our lives. It's our heritage. I think of Psalm 16 and verse 6, one of my favorite portions, where he says, the lines have fallen to me in pleasant places. Indeed, my heritage is beautiful to me. But the longer you live in life, the more you feel that way. You look back upon your history, heritage, history. It's something that you have possessed. It's yours. You look back the way God has led. That's what he's talking about when he says the lines are pleasant to me or have fallen to me in pleasant places. God's been good to me. If you say that, then God's been good to me. God has provided for us. Thomas Leo, and I'll quote from him frequently here, says, it is a common fault with men of discontent, or he said peevish, which means discontent or cantankerous. It's a common fault with men of discontent and fretful dispositions to praise past ages and to mourn over the degeneracy of the times in which they have the misfortune to live. This is often the vice of age. For the old man is proverbially a praiser of the times when he was a boy and a severe censor of youth and all that is new and fresh, end quote. You know the proverbial story. When I was a kid, I walked 2 miles to get the bus, you know, with tattered shoes and all this kind of thing. And your bus comes to pick you up right in front of your house. What are you complaining about? Thomas Leon wrote in 1900. And yet his words are very relevant, and I find them very helpful. It is a warning to the aged, is it not? It's a warning to me, it's a warning to anyone who is older. It has application for everybody, and when we come to the end of this sermon, I'll try to talk about youth a little bit and how youth can relate to this. Warning to the aged, no doubt, that the older man, the older woman, looks back on his or her past and complains about the present and can't even get excited about youth and freshness. So let's go to the second point then. First, we consider what people say, which is what we have in the text. Now, why people say this? Well, I see two reasons why we would be tempted to say this. And they are simply discontentment with decay and discontentment with development. Why do people say this? Why is it that the former days were better than these? Or put it in a positive state. Former days were better than these. Excuse me, let me just lower this volume here. So I see two reasons. Discontentment with decay. The decay is all around us. Let me just mention some of the things that are obvious to you. There's moral decay, which is so, it's before our eyes every day. We can see it now in a way that we couldn't see it in the 60s or the 70s when I was growing up. We see moral decay. We see social decay, political decay, and educational decay. But these are all serious manifestations of decay and corruption. And someone can become so discontent with this and just long for the past. And saying what the writer says here, the former days were better than these. And I won't go into all of these because it's just not necessary for our sermon today to delve into all of the manifestations of moral, social, political, or educational decay. I think you're thinking people and you know what all of these areas mean. But the issue here for us in a sermon like this, in an exposition like this, is to understand why people would say this. Because they're discontent with decay. Should we be content with decay? Well, when we come to the application, I think I'll be able to set this in a proper light for you. But this is why it's said. And secondly, why people say this is because a discontentment with development. Naturally, life develops. Everything develops. Morality develops. It can develop in a good way, it can develop in a bad way, but everything develops. Social relations develop, whether in a good way or in a bad way. Everything develops. That's the way life is. It grows. So there's a discontentment with development. And leading some to say, well, how did we get here? The former times were better than these. But let me just focus on two areas of development here with which a person may become discontent. And the first one is, folks call it modernity. I don't want to get into modernity, post-modernity, and whatever else comes next, which apparently we're in. Some people know a lot more about that than I do. But just modern life, that's all I mean by that, modern life. Discontentment with modern life. This happens especially with those who are older, because modern life has many blessings, but it also causes much grief. Ecclesiastes 1 and verse 18, Solomon had said, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. And so modern life with all of its offerings and conveniences, or whatever we shall call them, can become a source of discontentment, longing for a simpler life. And the other one is technology. Technology. In history, you have various periods of where you have a revolution, an industrial revolution, or a revolution in thought, or a revolution in, such as we have in the Reformation, which is a spiritual revolution, or we call it a reformation. So we're living in the period of the revolution of technology. And we're still feeling our way with this, aren't we? Are we not? It changes so quickly, year by year, decade by decade. So I call technology the two-faced gift to modern life. The two-faced gift of modern life. And what I mean by this is that technology has two faces. I think that's the way we need to look at it. It has two faces. It has a happy face and a sinister face. It's just like saying there's a good side and a bad side. But I like to think of them in terms of faces. It has a happy face because it's a gift. It gives you much, much good. It paves the way for you in many ways, in many areas of life to better your life. It's a happy face. But it also has with it, and at the same time, in the same entity, a sinister face. A sinister face. That face that wants to consume you, that wants to snare you, that wants to tempt you, that wants you to pull you away from heavenly things. So those are the two reasons why I think people say this. Because they're discontent with decay and discontent with development. Now that's different from saying that I recognize that there's decay in this world, or I recognize that there's development in this world, and I'll deal with it. That's the way we should look at it. But this is a complaint, verse 10. Why is it that the former days were better than these? It's a statement that the former days were better than these. The former days were better than these. And then the complaint. Why? Because of decay. Because of development. Leo, writing in the 1900 approximately, said, this complaint arises from dissatisfaction with the present. Number one. So let's pause there for a minute. That this is his analysis of it, which is also true. It arises from dissatisfaction with the present. And secondly, he says it arises from the illusion of distance, the fictitious glory of the past. When we talk about the past and we say the past is better than today, he's saying it's a fictitious glory. You're speaking from the standpoint of distance. You don't have the past before your face as you have the present to deal with. He calls it the fictitious glory of the past, and there's certainly truth to that. So what people say, why they say it, and now thirdly, what is wrong with saying this? And I'm going to give you five reasons why saying this or thinking this way is wrong. Why having this kind of discontentment with the present, having this discontentment with the decay that is all around us, or the developments of life, which have these two faces to them, is wrong. It's wrong to feel this way. It's wrong to think this way. It's wrong to talk this way. For five reasons. Number one, because saying this does not understand the nature of sin. The nature of sin. Sin spreads. Sin is sinister. Sin deepens its roots. Paul says sin takes an opportunity through the commandment. It takes what is good. It takes an opportunity, even through what is good, to exploit its nefarious plans, the nature of sin. Why complain about the present and the decay that you see all around you when this is what we would expect with the curse of sin in the world? So number one, it does not understand the nature of sin. Number two, it fails to see the inevitable development of culture. My wife and I went back to Genesis in reading in our morning devotions. We're in Genesis chapter 10, which shows the development of culture, the building of the first city. And the point of that is that this is what happens in cultures developing. Without God, they don't develop in the right way or the good way, but they develop. And so as they develop, they produce all kinds of aberrations and things with which you might become very unhappy or discontent and try to take refuge in the past. You fail to see the inevitable development of culture. In my lifetime, or in our lifetime, some of us here, We saw, you know, after the war, post-war, and then you had the hippie generation, and Woodstock, and sexual revolution. So the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, now 2021, you're seeing the inevitable result or fruit of what was planted there. They also see the inevitable development of culture. We're not saying that culture develops properly. We're not saying that we should accept and go with the flow and just accept what the culture is doing. That's not the point. Thirdly, what's wrong with saying this? It does not give place to the providence of God. And the fourth point is similar to this, so I'll mention it. It does not see the purposes of God at work. But the third point, it does not give place to the providence of God. If we dwell on the corruption and the decay and the bad developments of life and the sinister face of technology, if we just dwell on that, and if we start to complain about that, and if it takes our joy away, then we're failing to give proper place to the providence of God, which is that He cares for His creation. His care is over all His works. And He's also in control of the heart of men and the activities of the human race. Number four, it does not see the purposes of God at work. That God is at work in history. The proper view of history is to call it redemptive history. It's not just history. It's kind of bland in a way. Just history. The Christian doesn't see just history. Because history by itself conveys this idea that it's man who is driving everything. But redemptive history, I don't mean to be irreverent, puts God in the driver's seat, if you will. It shows that God's providence and purpose is at work. God has a purpose. He's overruling. We recognize the activity of the devil. We recognize that he has much power. He can appear before God and condemn Job and afflict judgment on him and on his flesh and in his family. But he can only go so far because God is ultimately in control, and God gives him the permission to do that. So God's purpose is at work. But the fifth point is in the book itself. Again, please turn back to chapter 3, which is in chapter 3, verses 1 through 11, is the central part of this entire book. Everything in the book of Ecclesiastes must be related to chapter 3. Solomon already laid the groundwork for this perspective problem, the perspective problem of how to relate the present to the past, and the temptation to think that the past was better than the present, or to say things like, I wish I could live in the past again. Or to say, I was born 50 years too late. I would have rather have been born in the days of the founding of our country. Things like that. Solomon already laid the groundwork for this perspective problem. When he said, there is an appointed time for everything. There is a time for every event under heaven. A time to give birth and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. A time to search and a time to give up as lost. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear apart and a time to sew together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything beautiful, literally beautiful or appropriate. Beautiful is better. It's more accurate. He has made everything beautiful. The Hebrew word means that. But let the words sink in there. He, God, has made everything. Well, everything that he just mentioned. Not some generic everything, but everything that he just mentioned. He, God, has made, that's causation, everything which he just mentioned, beautiful, in its time. So the past has beautiful things, and the present has beautiful things. Everything that he just mentioned. Now, that's my interpretation or my assessment or explanation of what's wrong with saying is those five things. Now I'm going to take the rest of the time to quote from a number of writers, okay? We're all in agreement, but I just wanted you to hear the words of others. So first of all, I'm going to quote a bit lengthier from Thomas Leal, who says, the dreamy admiration of antiquity, or of history, the dreamy admiration of antiquity is the refuge of weak minds. justification of their discontent. They despise actual life around them and the ways of beauty as too prosaic, thus injuring their moral force by the excesses of the imagination. If we follow the fancied superiority of past ages with a sober and impartial eye, we shall find that it retires into the region of mist and fable. Some Christians mourn over the lack of spirituality and earnest purpose in the church of the present. They sigh for the ideal perfection which marked primitive times with the early church. But a closer examination would soon dispel this illusion. Even in the times of the apostles, the passions of human nature and the infirmities of the human mind both disfigured the life of the church and corrupted the truth. The golden age for our race lies in front of us, not behind us. Humanity is ever toiling up to the heights of progress from evil to greater good. Those who unduly praise past ages fix their attention upon a few illustrious names and challenge the present times for the production of their like. In other words, it's like saying, well, we've never had a good president like George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or whoever else we want to name. Ronald Reagan. Let's throw that in. I'll stop right there. There's another one I'd like to mention. Those who unduly praise past ages fix their attention upon a few illustrious names and challenge the present times for the production of their like. They forget that those famous men do not represent the average of their contemporaries, but stood at their head and top. Their moral heroes are but brilliant points of light scattered sparingly through the long dark vista of the past. This is helpful. I find this very helpful. And I like the way he explains this. Charles Bridges says, but the rebuke is evidently directed against that dissatisfied spirit which puts aside our present blessings, exaggerates our evils, and reflects upon the government of God as full of inequalities and upon his providence in having put us in such evil times. This is an important warning from an older writer. He says it's a dissatisfied spirit, let me say it again, which puts aside the present blessings, exaggerates our evils, and reflects upon the government of God as full of inequalities and upon his providence, complains about his providence, in other words, and having put us in such evil times. So why couldn't I have been born 50 years earlier? Warren Wiersbe says, one of the marks of maturity is the ability to look at life in perspective and not get out of balance. When you have God's wisdom, you will be able to accept and deal with the changing experiences. Lupo, older writer, I think 1950-something, writes, according to the connection in which the statement occurs, the author clearly upholds the thought that the ultimate conclusion to which God will bring things, verse 8, is far better than any stage of development that may be arrived at previously. So the glorious outcome which God will bring about, a man should turn his hope and expect far better things. Otherwise, he asks not out of wisdom in regard to this matter. Thomas Leal again, says, this tendency to the undue glorification of past times can only be corrected by study and reflection, by the cultivation of a contented mind, and by that sobriety and judgment which frees a man from the slavery of the unreal. Now, there's these are powerful phrases this man is using. Slavery to the unreal, bondage to the past, or what he also calls the fictitious glory of the past. And Charles Bridges says, the rebuke, oh, I already quoted that. So in closing now, let me ask two questions. How should we view the past in light of the present? And second question is, how should we view the past and the present in light of the future? So first of all, how should we view the past in light of the present? The verse is not saying that you shouldn't factor in the past. The verse is not saying that there's nothing good in the past. The verse is not saying that you don't have a goodly heritage to rejoice in. So what is it saying? Well, it's saying, number one, that it is our heritage. It's not our inheritance, though. And I'm saying that just because the sermon for the next hour is 1 Peter chapter 1, which talks about our inheritance, which is incorruptible and undefiled and doesn't fade away. It just happened that these two sermons, the thought was there for me. The past is our heritage. It's not our inheritance. It's one thing to say, they're stealing away, they're chipping away at our heritage. They are. They're trying to rob our heritage from us. They are. They want to change the order. They want to change the constitution. They want to change this. They want to change that. And yes, there is a scheme for a new world order that has been in the works for a long time. But our heritage is not our inheritance. They cannot take that away from us. So the past is our heritage, especially with regard to our personal lives. Your heritage is Psalm 16, is something for which you thank the Lord. You thank the Lord for the way He led you, for the way the parents that He gave you, for the upbringing that you had, for the spouse that He brought to you, for the way He helped you through a divorce, whatever it is. That's your heritage. How He provided for you, how He got you started in your married life, how He's helped you in your singleness, all of that. That's your heritage. You rejoice in that. And Psalm 16 is your banner in that. But it's not your inheritance. That's forward. First of all, how should we view the past? It's our heritage. Secondly, it affords pleasant memories. Pleasant memories of days gone by are not being condemned by this passage. It's the discontentment that comes, that wants to hook back to the past and wants to hook to those memories and doesn't want any trouble today to affect those memories. It affords pleasant memories, but that's all they are. They're memories, something to enjoy, something to be thankful for, something to look at in photo albums, something to watch in old movies. I have a word to say about that in a minute. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. But pleasant memories of what life was like. Thirdly, the past is not only our heritage and afford pleasant memories, but it's also our teacher. We have always believed and we emphasize that we learn from the past. Those who don't learn from the past are doomed to repeat its failures, as they say. It's our teacher. You have to know history. It teaches us lessons and can be a guide for the present. There's definitely a trend in modern life to want to put off history as a teacher. We don't want to learn lessons. Want to say we. The culture generally doesn't want to learn from the past. They want freedom. They want self-expression. They want to live the way they want to live. The history gets in the way. So you try to change the history books. But history is a teacher. And fourthly, history is God's work. It's God's work in redemptive history. It's God's work. For we don't view history as just bland history, or mere history is better. Mere history. Which gives a sense that man is in control, but redemptive history. God's in control. So that's how we view the past. And for young people, I want to exhort young people, if you're happy to listen to this, to know the history. This verse is mainly targeted to older people who complain about the present and want to live in the past or want God to bring it back for their enjoyment again. So what should young people do? Well, you should know the history so that you won't be caught up in the web of the present. Secondly, and we'll close with this, how should we view the past and the present in light of the future? Well, I have two things to say about this, and I'll give you some quotes as well. First of all, we can't be bound to the past. We can't live in the past so that we cannot move forward. So we cannot be bound to the past. We can't live in the past. We can enjoy the past. We can view it as our heritage. We can extract from it the pleasant memories that are there. We can let it teach us. But we can't live in it. We live in today. Naturally, it's obvious. It's so obvious that you wonder how anyone could miss it. You don't live in the past. The past is past doesn't give you an experience. The past isn't something you have to deal with today. Today has an agenda for you and me, as this does this week. So if we live in the past or are bound to the past, then we will not be able to move forward. We won't be able to adjust to the decay. We say, I don't like this decay. I don't like this moral decay. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And so you retreat into this bubble of the past. And then you're paralyzed. You can't deal with it. So I don't want to deal with it. It's different from saying, this is attention, isn't it? I deal with this in my own life. How much news I want to read, or how much awareness I want to have. It's different because there's so much stuff out there that you could be so consumed from day to day. You know, it used to be that, you know, you got your news in increments when things developed. But now you follow the development of everything almost to the minute, which is not good. It's not healthy. It's not good. We must stop doing that. In that sense, better to go back to the past when we didn't have these advantages, these technological, I don't think they're necessarily advantages to get up to the minute news every day, every hour. Let things develop so that you have time to live your life. So we can adjust the decay and the development of things at a reasonable pace that factors in the other things that God is doing, like building His church, advancing His kingdom, spreading the gospel, give you time for your prayer life, for your meditation, for the cultivation of peace, for the cultivation of your peace and your, I don't say sanity, but your peace. Because in one sense, the present will drive you mad. Secondly, then, we must make the most of the present, lest it slip from us. And here I'm going to rely on the statement of a couple of men. One is Warren Wiersbe and one is Charles Bridges, and then stop. But here's the point, though. We must make the most of the present, lest it slip from us. Don't be bound to the past, and make the most of the present. Otherwise, it's going to slip away from you. Warren Wiersbe quoted a Victorian named Bella, who said, while you are dreaming of the future or regretting the past, the present, which is all you have, slips from you and is gone. I'll say it again, or I'll let him speak. While you are dreaming of the future or regretting the past, the present, which is all you have, slips from you and is gone. Charles Bridges is especially good on this, his commentary on this verse. He says, if the times are bad, what are we doing to mend them? And submit to what we cannot change. We must submit to what we cannot change. Now, that doesn't mean that you accept moral aberration or you just go with the flow. It's not the same thing. It's you submit to what we cannot change, you accept God's providence. Bridges goes on to say, leave God's work to Him, and let us attend to our own work, to serve our generation by the will of God, and to let the badness of the age make us more wise, circumspect, and humble. Lord, thank you so much for Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 10. Lord, help us to reflect on these things, and help us, Lord, through this verse in Ecclesiastes, to find much help for living our lives today, dealing with the past, living in the present, and facing the future. We ask it in Christ's name. Amen.